Okay, so by now we have actually gone through the three big components of the class: process management, memory management, I/O and storage management. Okay, so any operating system has sort of these three big components. So that's basically, here's a list of all the topics we have done, starting from architecture all the way to file systems and I/O. Okay. So what we will do in the next three or four classes that are remaining is to focus on distributed systems. Okay. So today I'll talk a little bit about networking, just to set the stage for what is coming down in the next two classes or so, two or three classes. If you have taken 453, this may be repetition, but not everybody who takes 377 has taken the networking class, so I need to provide a little bit of background, which I am going to do today. Okay, so if you know this material, please bear with me. Then next time we will talk about remote procedure calls. Okay, and then we'll talk about distributed file systems. Okay, so that's sort of what is remaining in the class. Basically, the last few classes will all focus on distributed systems. For those of you who are interested in this topic, I teach a graduate level class, an entire course on this topic, the 677. Occasionally some undergraduate students take it. It's not recommended, but if you're really interested, you should come see me. I'm going to teach it in the spring. Okay, so that's just as an aside. So let's start with the definition of what a distributed system is. Essentially, it is a distributed system typically consists of a set of nodes or processors that are interconnected by some network, by some communication medium, which typically is a network. Okay, there's a picture of it there. But the way to think about this is basically every system, every computing system that you see today that has a network attached to it is some form of a distributed system. Practically any application that you use today is a distributed application. Okay, think of email as a distributed system. Okay, your mail clients talking to mail servers over a network. Okay. Web is an example of a global scale distributed system. There are lots of servers that are serving content, lots of users accessing this content through browsers. Okay? So these are machines that are all talking to one another over a wide area network, which just happens to be the internet. Okay? File servers, network printers, remote backups, they are all examples of a distributed system. Okay? So the way to think about this is modern applications or systems are distributed in some shape or form. Okay? Operating systems have to evolve to support the needs of these applications. So what is it that an application should provide as an abstraction? Okay? So we look at three different things. One is a network stack. Okay? That's really not part of this course. That's part of a course on computer networking. I'll talk about a little bit of that today just to set the background. So once you have a networking stack that allows a machine or a application running on a machine to communicate with some other entity, we need some OS level abstraction. So next time we are going to talk about remote procedure calls or RPCs. In the Java world, they are called remote methods, okay, RMIs. So we'll look at that and see how you can use the abstraction of an RPC or RMI to build a distributed application. Okay? And then we'll talk about distributed file systems. Okay, these are file systems that run on multiple nodes that serve files to any application, okay, which is basically a generalization of whatever we have looked at until now in the file system context, where you have a single disk, single machine. So now we'll look at how multiple disks or running on multiple machines can collectively serve content to large numbers of users. Okay. These file systems have now become global scale. Okay, so you can go from single machine to, let's say, department or university that may be running a distributed file system on a few nodes. Okay, if you look at really very large scale applications, they are served by global scale distributed file system. Practically any web service that you use, let's say Gmail or Google Docs or any of these services, they actually run running underneath is a very large global scale file system. In the case of these Google services, they have their own called a Google file system. that runs on tens of thousands of machines serving content. The content may be your mail, any document that you store, your pictures and whatnot. Okay? So it's instructive to understand how to design the system, and the systems can be anywhere, from two machines. Any two processes talking to one another on two different machines is a distributed system. Tens of thousands of processes talking across the internet on a global scale are also examples of distributed systems. So this is a very large scale, okay, that goes from two machines to tens of thousands of machines. Okay, so here we will try to define this term a little more carefully and distinguish it from another class of system which also generalizes from a single machine model, which is parallel systems. Okay? So today, actually, if you buy any reasonable machine, laptop, desktop, servers, they will come with multiple cores. Okay? 2 cores, 4 cores, 8 cores, 16 cores and whatnot. Okay? That's an example of a parallel system. In a parallel system, you have multiple processes running on the same machine, on possibly on multiple processors or multiple CPUs, that talk to one another. Okay, they execute in parallel. Okay, so there's a tight coupling between the processes because they run on the same machine. They share memory. Okay, they might share memory. There's typically one OS running on that machine. Okay, but there are still indistinct processes communicating with one another. In distributed systems, you have what are called loosely coupled systems. So here, processes are running on independent machines, not on the same machine. They are communicating over a medium, which is a local area network. It could be a wireless network, a wired network, or it could be a wide area network, such as the internet. The coupling is loose. Okay, there is no shared memory. Okay, there are multiple OSs involved. They may not even be the same OS. The client may be running on one platform, the server may be running on a different platform. There is heterogeneity and loose coupling. So whenever we say distributed systems, we mean these loosely coupled systems, not tightly coupled. Okay, so if you have two processes that are running on, let's say, a dual core desktop or a laptop that are interacting with one another, that would be an example of a parallel system from based on a tight definition, not a distributed system. So it's important to understand the difference between the two. Okay, parallel systems are also an important class of emerging application. As you get more and more cores packed onto a single machine, every application is turning into essentially a parallel application using multi-threading, for example. Okay, you have a multi-threaded application that runs on concurrently on multiple cores is an example of a parallel application. So with multiple cores, applications are going parallel. But with multiple machines as well, some applications are also distributed. So important to understand the difference between what's a parallel system and what's a distributed system. Okay, so there's some difference between the two. Questions on this? Yeah. Okay. So one could ask, why design systems to be distributed? Why not build a larger centralized system? Okay, what do we get from making system distributed? Okay, the downside of any distributed system is it's a lot more complex to build, design and build. Okay, more work is involved in writing code for a distributed system than if everything were centralized. Okay, things get harder to debug, is it more difficult to write, multiple people, coordination, etc. Okay, so there are two important reasons to make a system distributed. Okay, resource sharing is one, okay, computational speed up is another. So what is resource sharing? Okay, resource sharing essentially says that if your system is distributed, you are able to share resources on one machine from a different machine. Okay, resources here is used in a very general sense. So resource could be a disk. Okay, so if you have a network file system, which is an example of a distributed system, you can access files stored on a different machine, files stored on a file server. Okay, that's an example of a distributed system. That's resource sharing. Okay, you are sharing the disk storage resources stored somewhere else. Okay. So, and the same is true for arbitrary resources. You can have a printer as a resource. So if you connect a printer to your machine and you share this printer, some other client can remotely print to this printer. Okay, that client doesn't require a printer to be connected to it natively. That's another example of sharing. Okay, so there are many, many such examples. Okay, so what distributed systems do is by allowing you remote access to resources, you can share those resources. Okay, very important advantage for doing this. So that's one. The second thing it does is computational speed up. Okay, because in a distributed system, you have more than one machine. Okay, so let's say, so this is your network. Okay, so you have n machines participating in some distributed system or application. They are all communicating over a network. You can harness the computational power on n of these machines or n processors. Okay, so you can essentially run your application or partition your application across n, and you might get n times the speed up. Okay, so there are many uses of distributed systems that basically harness the computational resources on multiple machines. Okay, so there are, if you have heard of Hadoop or MapReduce, so these are batch applications that run on large number of machines in a cluster. Okay, they harness the computational resources or the CPU on all of these machines to basically have lower completion time. Okay, because you have n times the speed up. You can do batch simulation, very large scale simulations, such as those used in the financial industry or pharmaceutical industry, maybe doing some drug discovery. You have lots of computational job. You can run them on a distributed set of nodes and finish your jobs faster. Okay, so you get computational speed up. And the nice thing about this is as you add more nodes to your system, you have get more and more processing power at your disposal, so you can run your jobs faster, assuming you can distribute them across this large set of nodes. Okay, so resource sharing, computational speed up are two important advantages, but that's not those are not the only ones. The other one is reliability. Okay, if you design your distributed system properly, okay, and that basically is a big if, then a distributed system can actually give you better reliability than a single centralized system. Okay, in a single centralized system, if that node fails, whatever service was running on it goes down. Okay, let's say it's a mail server. Your mail server running on one machine. Okay, machine goes down. Mail is you can't access mail anymore. Okay, so system, your service has essentially become unavailable. In a distributed system, if you design it well such that there is no single point of failure, okay, if one node goes down, the system as a whole continues to function. The system is not impacted by the failure of one or some small number of nodes, because other nodes can take over the job that node was doing. Okay, so in the case of a mail server, if you have a clustered mail server, the mail server is running on a bank of machines, not a single one. If one machine goes down and your mail client tries to connect, it is automatically forwarded to a different machine. Okay, and that machine still has access to your mail inbox, so you can continue to access mail without knowing that anything went down. This is true of any large website as well. Most large websites are replicated on multiple machines. Okay, so if only one or some number of machines go down, the system continues to run. Any internet service that you access today has to use some form of reliability. Not all of them do. Okay, Twitter keeps going down. Okay, that's an example of a system that's not designed well, because it has single points of failure. Some nodes go down and the service fails. But many systems don't go down. Okay, Google search engine rarely goes down. Okay, because although many nodes in the system may be down at any given point in time, the system, the service as a whole continues to function because it is built with redundancy in place. Okay, so that's an important example of, advantage of distributed system. Okay, then the last one, which is sort of more a user specific advantage, is that distributed systems enable communication. Okay, so you have email, it allows you to communicate. That's an example of a distributed system. You can have chatbook, any social networking site, which is an example also of a distributed system, enables humans to communicate, do useful things. Okay, order stuff online, okay, buy airline tickets online. So lots of interesting things become possible because your system is distributed, okay, possibly over the internet. So there are these advantages. Now I did not list the disadvantages here. The disadvantages of distributed systems over centralized system is that they are more complex to design. You have to put in more reliability, you have to figure out how to use, partition your application across n machines, so a lot more complex application design. Okay? But if you design your application well, these benefits are sort of well worth the price, which is why most applications you see are distributed. Okay? So, there are many new emerging examples of distributed system. If you heard about cloud computing, which is sort of a new buzzword that you hear in the popular press, that is the latest incarnation of distributed systems. Okay, in cloud computing, you can actually go rent resources by the hour, okay, pay for servers and storage by the hour or by the kilobyte. Okay, and you have at your disposal very large amounts of storage and computational resources distributed in some shape or form that you can access over the internet. Okay. This sort of basically new applications of distributed systems keep coming up. Okay, this is the most recent one, but there are many, many that sort of keep coming up. Okay, so now with that was a very quick discussion of where distributed systems help. What we are really interested in understanding is, since this is a course on operating systems, is what operating systems need to do, okay, to enable applications to be distributed in some shape or form. Okay. Now, clearly, since a distributed system inherently assumes some form of communication, one thing that your operating system needs to do is to implement some form of networking support. Okay. Any operating system that does this, and today every possible operating system that is in use does this, is referred to as a network operating system because it implements networking out of the box. So we will. So that's really the fourth component of any kernel. Okay, process management, memory management, storage management are three. Okay, and the fourth one really happens to be networking. These are the four components. But really, we study networking as a part of a different course. So TIP traditionally is not taught in this class. Okay, but we will, for whatever we need to know about distributed system, do a quick primer on networking today. Okay. So now there are many facets of distributed systems which we will really not talk in lot more detail, but there are several interesting or important things. Okay, one is called transparency. Okay, so distributed systems, well designed distributed systems, hide lots of intricate details from the user. Okay, user doesn't need to know what those details are. Okay, that's what transparency means, in order to use the system. Okay, there are many forms of transparency. One is called location transparency. Okay, this is easily understood from using the web as an example. Okay, in the web, to go to any website, okay, you need to use a URL. Okay, URL may be www.umass.umass.edu. Okay, that's all you need to know to access the UMass web server. Okay, and the claim is that is location transparent because this URL doesn't encode in it the location of the server. Okay, you don't know whether the UMass web server is actually hosted somewhere in Amherst or is running somewhere else, in some data center somewhere. You don't know, you shouldn't know or care. Okay, all you need is to go to this website, you know its address, you go to it. Okay. There are many other forms of transparency. Okay, but the important thing is good applications hide lots of these details. Okay, so another example is Google. Okay, The Google search engine runs on tens of thousands of servers, okay, or literally tens of thousands of servers. Now, this is not at all visible to you as the user. Okay, the interface that is provided to you is that of a simple search box. When you type in a search query, you, the user, don't say send this query to the 5,000th server and have it process the results and send back the return results. Okay, the system takes care of it. It figures out where you are coming from, which server to send your query to. It can detect which country you are sending this query from, send it to servers within that country for improved speed. All of this is done internally. You don't have to deal with this. Okay, neither should you have to. Okay, there's another form of transparency, that all these details of what the user is asking for and how to get it to the user is done internally by the system. Okay. Now, this makes the system a lot more complex, but it makes it much more easy to use from a user standpoint. This is an important thing to keep in mind when you design distributed systems, is what to hide from the user and put intelligence in the system to deal with it, and what to expose so that the users might need to exercise some control for what they are trying to do with the system. Okay. So that's important. The other thing that is also very important with any distributed system is security. Okay, this is again topic of an entire course which we will not deal with here. But as you open up your system over a network, then you basically become vulnerable to security attacks. Okay, so that probably is clear, as you heard of viruses and malware and what have you. Okay, so it is very important when you design distributed systems to keep security in mind, because sooner or later, if your service or application becomes popular, it is going to be the target of security attacks. Okay, so to deal with security as a first-hand design principle is very important. Okay. This you never worry about. When you write an application, you don't really worry about how do you make it secure. Your first thought is how do you make it run fast. Okay, so you think of performance as the first design criteria. Okay, security is almost always an afterthought, which is why security is a big problem, because most applications are written in the way we think of. Let's make it fast, let's make it work, then we will think of how to make it secure. But doing that opens up a lot of holes, because you haven't actually thought of security as a design concern when you build the system. Okay? In centralized applications, it may not matter as much. In a distributed application where your user can be sitting anywhere on the internet, it matters a lot, because the application sooner or later is going to be target of attacks. Okay? You hear of all sorts of attacks, people going in attacking ATM networks and withdrawing money from your banks. In fact, all of these machines just run some form of operating system. They are distributed systems. Okay, so it's an important thing to keep in mind, but something that is rarely paid attention to in design of system. Okay, reliability I talked about already, performance and scale already we said can harness the power of n machines, so you get basically good, better performance and better scalability than traditional system. Okay, programming model is another important thing. Okay, because distributed systems are much harder to design, the abstractions that we provide to the programmer also become important. So you see lots of new development in this particular area as well, just in the context of web application development. Okay, you probably heard of Ruby on Rails and Python web frameworks and whatnot. Okay, the reason they have been designed, it's not that you cannot write an entire web application in C or Java. You can indeed, and there are many out there, but they are much harder to write. It takes a lot more effort. So to enable more programming power, I mean not programming power, but more programmer productivity, we have new programming models come up all the time. Okay? MapReduce is another programming model that allows you to write parallel data intensive or data processing application. The Ruby on Rails programming model that allows you to write web applications. So all of these are targeted towards writing distributed systems in some shape or form. Okay, so and you see new such models coming up almost every few months. Okay, some new thing sort of becomes popular. So that's another important aspect, to provide programmer with the right tools and abstractions so they can write these distributed systems better, faster. Okay, so with that background, we'll now do a quick primer on networking. Okay, so as you probably all know what a network, computer network is. So it's basically a communication medium that allows processes or applications to send messages back and forth. Okay, so we will distinguish in our discussion between a local area network, which is also called a LAN, from a wide area network, which is called a WAN. Okay, in a local area network is essentially a network that connects a group of nodes within an organization, within a building, within a campus, okay, some small geographic area. Okay. Examples of local area network: Ethernet, Wi-Fi, Gigabit Ethernet, all of these are examples of local area networks. Okay. Wide area networks are networks that connect machines over larger geographies. Okay, within a city, within a state, country, continents. Okay, so these are all examples of wide area networks. There are different ways to build wide area networks. Okay, so you might have fiber going from one location to another. Okay, so that's basically, you typically use fiber optic networks to connect these machines. You can also use copper. Okay, they are typically smaller speeds. You can have microwave links. Old networks basically relied on telephone service. Okay, the telephone network was used to connect nodes, and the speeds were very slow, as you can imagine. But more modern ones use everything from microwave links to fiber optic cables, undersea cables, satellite channels. They are all used to enable communication over larger distances. Okay. So the internet that you actually see today is a combination of these kinds of networks. Okay, so it's not a single network. These networks are connected by all sorts of links. Okay, so they have different speeds all the way down from a megabit to hundreds of gigabits. Okay, if you have a high end fiber, you may get 100 gigabit per second or more of communication bandwidth. The important thing to keep in mind is that here nodes are connected over longer distances, here they are connected over shorter distances. Okay. New forms of network technologies basically are also emerging all the time. There are 3G networks, there are 4G networks that are coming out, WiMAX. So they are all examples of new forms of wide area networks. Okay. They are all wireless, not wired. Questions on this? Okay. Now, the reason I have mentioned this here is when you build a distributed system, the first thing that you have to ask yourself is this application going to run primarily on a LAN or will it run over a WAN? Okay, so there are many applications that are optimized for LAN. Okay, file servers are a good example. Traditional file servers that you see, NFS or Windows file service, they are optimized assuming that they will traditionally run over a LAN, that the client and the server are actually on a local area network. A different set of considerations have to be taken into account if you design applications to run over a WAN. Okay, web is an example of an application that's primarily optimized for WAN, okay, not LAN. Okay, because HTTP, the way the protocol is designed, etc., it sort of assumes that your traffic is going to flow over a WAN. Okay, so these things matter in what design choices you make for your application. Okay, so there are many topologies. Regardless of whether you have a LAN or WAN, there are different topologies to connect these nodes, and we are going to quickly go through them. Okay, the simplest one is fully connected topology. Okay, in a fully connected topology, every node has a physical wire that connects it to every other node in the network. Okay, so the advantage of a fully connected network is Christmas. The advantage of a fully connected network is every message only takes one hop. Okay, so if any node in this network has to send a message to some other node, it will basically traverse on one link, okay, which means that it basically takes one hop for that message to get to its destination. Okay, so it's fast because all messages take one hop. Okay. Disadvantage is, of course, it's expensive. Can't really have wires connecting every node to every other node. Yeah, that's an order n square problem. Okay, we'll have order n square wires, and soon as n grows, we'll be relaying too many wires. It just doesn't scale. Okay, it's okay for small networks to be fully connected, but most practical networks won't be fully connected. But this is a starting point for a topology. You wanted to have nodes communicate, you will basically just have wire communicating, connecting each of them to every other node. Any questions on fully connected? Because the next one is partially connected. So this is basically just saying that rather than having wires connect every node, we'll only have some links connecting some of the nodes. Okay, but then the network as a whole, which is a graph, is essentially connected, meaning that you can go from any node to every other node via some other intermediate nodes. Okay, so whenever you have partially connected topologies, okay, the network needs to provide a functionality called routing. Okay. Routing is essentially the problem of how to get a packet or a message from its source to a destination through some path in the network. Okay, the network decides what path your message is going to take. Very similar to the way postal service decides, if you decide to mail a letter, what path is it going to take, which truck is it going to go on, which intermediate destination does the truck go through for your letter to get to its destination. The network has to make the same decision. In some cases there may be only one path, in some cases there may be more than one. So in this case, if you want to send a message from here to here, as you can see, there are two routes or two paths to get to it. Okay, one basically that goes this way and the other that goes that way. Okay, and your network can decide how to route your messages. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, designing a network that's partially connected is less expensive. There are fewer links, fewer wires to run than fully connected. Okay. Now, the problem with when you have sort of fewer wires is that your network can get partitioned if some links fail. Okay. So if one of those links there fails, okay, your basically network will be partitioned into two. Nodes in the first half will not be able to send messages to nodes in the second half. Okay. This often happens, as you can imagine, if your home, let's say, cable router DSL router goes down, you are essentially partitioned into two islands. One is your home LAN, if you have a router, and the rest of the world. Okay, there are no packets can go between these two. Okay, that's because there's only one link connecting you to the rest of the world. If that link goes down, you get disconnected. Okay. Now, more susceptible to failures, and you need routing algorithm. And messages will now take multiple hops, have to traverse multiple links to go from the source to the destination. Okay. Next topology is tree structure. Okay, so here your route in the network. Okay, every message essentially goes all the way up to a common ancestor and starts coming down. That's the routing that a tree network will use. Okay, so if you basically send a net message from here to the other node, it will go up to all the way to the root and start descending. Okay. Now this is often hierarchy is often hierarchical network, often used in corporations. Okay, or in most large organizations, you like hierarchy. Okay. So if you look at the domain name system, the way IP addresses are generated, any large organization, okay, you will basically see that there is a convention. Okay, so let's say CS, UMass, EDU is a hierarchical system that consists of three parts. There are all nodes that belong to this educational domain. UMass is a node within that domain, and the computer science department is basically a network in that hierarchy. Okay, you can have actually more hierarchies there if you want. Okay, so corporations, large organizations, they all use this form of topology. Okay, so there is a router at each of the entities, and that basically allows you to do routing in this form. Okay, so that's tree structure. Okay, the next one, is star topology. Okay, in a star topology, there's a centralized node that all nodes connect to. Okay, and the centralized node is essentially responsible for relaying traffic back and forth. Okay, so every node, essentially to communicate with any other nodes, basically it sends its message to the centralized node, and the centralized node forwards it to the next node. Okay, each message here takes only two hops, okay, which is good. In a partially connected or tree topology, it may take an arbitrary number of hops. Okay, in a star topology, it takes two hops. Okay, now the problem with this is that you have a single point of failure. Your node that sits in the between, in the middle, in a star topology, okay, has become a very important node. If that node goes down, there cannot be any communication in your network. Okay. Star topologies are typically used in many LAN networks. Okay, so there are LAN networks that essentially use a star topology. Okay, think of your Wi-Fi network as access point as a star topology. Okay, all the net nodes that are connecting to it are your wireless client. The node that's in between, okay, is essentially your access point. Okay, so to communicate with any other node, you first send your message to the access point. Assuming you want to talk to another wireless node within your wireless network, you send message to the AP. The AP is the access point. The access point will send it back. Okay, if your access point is down, there is no communication possible. Okay, so this is star topology. As I said, LANs use it, and examples use are Wi-Fi. Also your 3G networks that run, or cell towers also use this. Your cell tower is essentially the thing in between that is enabling communication between nodes. Okay, now cell towers may be themselves connected to the internet. So if your packet has to go out, you will no longer have a star topology. Any questions on star? Okay, so the last one is ring topology. No, not this. These are all point to point. So now we'll talk about ring network. So the ring topology, as the name suggests, your nodes are connected in a ring. Okay. And so you can have a unidirectional link, a ring, or a bidirectional ring. Okay. So here, if your node needs to send a message, basically, if let's say it's a unidirectional ring, then all messages, let's say, go clockwise. If you want to send a message to some other node, basically send it to the next node. So each node has two neighbors, a left neighbor and a right neighbor. Just send it to your left neighbor and it basically keeps forwarding the message until it gets to the destination. Okay. So anybody heard of token ring? Yes. Only one person. Okay. Two. Three. Okay. So before Ethernet took over as sort of the choice, de facto choice for LAN topology, there were two competing LAN technologies. There was a token ring network that IBM was sort of promoting, and there was the Ethernet with some other companies like 3Com and others pioneered, and they were promoting. And these were two competing technologies. So if about 10-15 years ago, if you wanted to actually buy a desktop, okay, there were no laptops then, so if you wanted to buy a desktop and you wanted to put it on a LAN, you have to decide which LAN your organization, okay, meaning your university or your company, actually used, and you have to buy a network card of that type. You could buy Ethernet card or you could buy a token ring card. Okay, if your company was in the IBM camp, you would essentially be on your machine, would sit on one of these networks. Okay. I haven't showed you what Ethernet looks like, but if your organization had chosen Ethernet as its LAN technology of choice, you have to buy a machine with a Ethernet card. Okay, eventually Ethernet won. Okay, so there are always these two technologies, Betamax and VHS and this kind of thing, so NTSC. And the same thing happened here. Okay, one took over, okay, which was Ethernet, and token ring basically died. Okay, so you don't hear of it anymore, but 15 years ago this was pretty large technology that was out there. And it had a pretty big market share. Okay. Now, there are many reasons it sort of went away. One is the problem with this topology is that if your actual machines on the LAN have to participate in the network. So, as you can see, there are N nodes. These are essentially NPCs. In the purest form, those are NPCs. So if one PC wants to talk to some other PC, send a message, you essentially send it along the ring. So think of what happens if you leave in the evening and switch off your PC. Okay, so if this machine is switched off, your ring is gone. Right? So now the communication no longer possible. So now the LAN topology has to figure it out and then maybe regenerate the ring by having this node directly talk to that node. Okay, so dealing with failures in token rings is a big problem, okay, because whenever any node fails, your ring is basically gone because all nodes are part of the ring. So there are lots of problems of this form. This is inexpensive, but failures partition the network. This is not true in Ethernet. In Ethernet, you can disconnect your machine from your Ethernet network, and the other machines can still talk to one another, as you will see. Yeah, but in a token ring, that's not the case. So all nodes have to be available for communication to be possible. Okay. So here, this is unidirectional ring where messages can flow in only one direction. You can have up to N-1 hops for your message to get to the destination. Okay. You could also have bidirectional links, rings where messages can go in either direction. So now if one node wants to send a message, it sends it either clockwise or anti-clockwise depending on which is nearer to the destination. So here at most N over 2 hops are necessary in a N node ring, okay, for a message to get to the destination. Yeah, so here can also tolerate single failures because You can always send messages the other way, okay, in the worst case. So those are ring topologies. Now, ring type topologies are also still used in logical application. This no physical LAN today probably uses this, because token ring is essentially dead as a technology, but many applications use logical rings. Okay, one important one is peer-to-peer applications. Okay, so there are many P2P applications, many of which started off as music sharing applications, but there are many legitimate ones also, Skype being one of them, which are P2P apps. They actually form a logical ring. Okay, so you essentially have these applications, these processes that talk to one another, but there's a topology that's imposed on the underlying physical topology, which is a logical ring topology, which dictates which process can talk to which other process in this distributed system directly. Okay, so if you can only talk to a left neighbor process and a right neighbor process, and everybody has the same constraint, you essentially impose a ring, a logical ring on your distributed application. Okay, if you can allow any process to talk to any other process, then you essentially have a more pure peer-to-peer communication. Okay, so it still lives in some applications that are out there, but not as a physical LAN topology technology. Yes, question.
So why would Skype be an example of a ring network topology? Because that it seems like in that case, if any time, you know, if I was trying to talk to someone across the room, it might need to skip, you know, we play this game of telephone,
so I should mention that the Skype is a peer-to-peer application. Okay, not all communication in Skype uses a logical ring for that matter. Okay, when you actually make your call, that just goes direct from one machine to another. It doesn't go in a ring. Okay, otherwise, if you have 10,000 users, you have a ring of 10,000 machines. That just doesn't make sense to send your voice traffic that way. Okay, but that said, peer-to-peer technology is used in Skype to do things like which of my contact people are signed in. So then Skype has to provide these services. Okay, these services are provided using peer-to-peer technology. Skype doesn't have a bank of servers sitting there checking who is logged in, who is not logged in, etc. Okay, some instant messaging services actually use centralized architectures like that. Okay, and Skype actually uses a fully distributed application where your machine, if it is well connected to your network, might suddenly get designated as a super peer in Skype, which means it not only is responsible for accepting connections from people wanting to talk to you, it is providing services to arbitrary users on Skype, which keeps track of which of your buddies are logged in and so on and so forth. So for those kinds of services, you use peer-to-peer. But when you initiate a call, that always goes direct. That doesn't go through other nodes. Okay, so there are many other forms of ring networks. There's one called doubly linked ring, where you are not only connected to your immediate neighbors, you are connected to neighbors that are one step removed from you. Okay, this allows you to do faster routing, okay, because you can always, so there is an inner ring and there is an outer ring, as you can see in this case. So you can always, if you send messages on the inner ring, you are skipping nodes. Okay, so you can actually get the message faster to the destination by using the inner ring and then using the outer ring. It's like using a sort of the inner lane of the highway and the outer, a fast lane and a slow lane. Okay? So in this case, messages take at most n over 4 hops. Okay? There are more wires here that are necessary, so it is more expensive than a single ring, but is more tolerant of failures. Okay? If one node goes down, you can see that the ring doesn't get partitioned, because there's a link that's already connecting that skips over you. Okay, so you can actually use that link to keep the ring going. Okay, so things like this are done. Okay, so those are all point-to-point connection topologies. The most LAN topologies use bus-based networks. Ethernet is a good example. Okay, so Ethernet uses a linear bus. Okay, in a bus-based medium, the network is shared by all the nodes. Okay, so any node can communicate or send out a packet to any other node. If two nodes are communicating at the same time, okay, you have what is called a collision. Okay, so basically, the message gets garbled because two people is like two people trying to talk in the room at the same time. The room is essentially a shared medium where you can only have one person talking if you want to make any sense. If lots of people speak up, all the messages or every words get garbled. Same is true here. Okay? So Ethernet is an example of a shared medium network where you basically have a network that is shared. Any node can start sending a packet, and if it's the only node sending out the packet, your basically packet is broadcast to all the nodes, and only the recipient takes delivery, everyone else discards that packet. Okay, so only one, if one node talks and nobody else is speaking or communicating, message transmission is successful. If multiple nodes try to send out packets, your message is basically you have what's called a collision, and one of these nodes are have to back off, okay, so that only one remains. Okay. So this is also called multi-access bus technology. It's very inexpensive. Okay, you can get Ethernet switches for or route hubs for like $10-$20. Okay, so very inexpensive, widely used. Okay, so so that was the original Ethernet topology, okay, which is a hub. So if you have what's called an Ethernet hub as opposed to an Ethernet switch, it essentially uses this. Modern versions of Ethernet. Okay, Ethernet started out as a 10 megabit per second technology. Okay, then you got 100 megabit per second Ethernet, order of magnitude faster. Then you got gigabit Ethernet. Okay, another order of magnitude faster. Now today you have 10 gigabit Ethernet. Okay, so technology has improved, but as the technology has improved, because you have very high speed networks, you can't afford to have too many collisions, etc. The way the LAN has actually evolved, the LAN technology is that today is no longer a shared medium, pure shared medium. Okay, you have switches which essentially make it look like a star topology. Okay, so you might have a switch. Yes, switch has ports. Okay, so you have machines connected. So in a switch, if this laptop is trying to talk to that laptop, there is a dedicated path that goes to the switch. Your packets are not broadcast. Okay. In a hub, you have the same . So in the Ethernet hub, if this machine sent out a packet, okay, your hub is actually going to broadcast it, which means it will send it out on all the ports. So every machine on your network will get a copy of that packet. That's called broadcast. Okay, so that is essentially what a bus-based medium does. Each of these machines actually is to look at the packet and say, look at the address on the packet, say, is this packet meant for me? Am I a destination? If it's not the destination, your Ethernet card will just throw it away. It will not take delivery. And only one machine, which is really the destination, takes delivery. Okay? So this is a completely shared medium, which is only one machine can communicate. In a switch, that's not the case. Your switch is intelligent enough to look at your packet and send the packet out on the right port, because it knows which nodes are connected on which ports. Okay. So this is modern Ethernet. This is essentially what is shown on that picture. Okay, just to make that clear. Okay, so single shared link. You can also have a ring based bus. Okay, which is the bus is shaped in the form of a ring and nodes are tapping into it. Okay, so same kind of trade offs as a linear bus. Okay, so that was a very quick overview of network topologies. Are there any questions on any of this? So let me ask, what do you think is Wi-Fi as a communication technology? Shared, dedicated? What topology does it use? Yes.
It's probably shared with a star topology, right? Because all traffic needs to go through the router, but also it's broadcast to everyone with a certain destination.
Okay, so it is shared. So it is true that it is shared. Okay, it is also today, it is still star, although there are many other ways to have wireless network. So the reason it is a shared medium is there is basically one channel. Okay, if one node is transmitting on the channel is in use. some other node tries to transmit bits on the wire, on the air, at the same time those bits are going to collide in the air and they are going to garble the signal. Because only one node can transmit at any one time, okay, in a wireless network. Okay, so either you are talking to the access point or the access point is talking. Access point is also a node. The access point is sending packets down to a wireless node, some other node cannot send. Okay? This is by design. Now technically you don't have to do this because Wi-Fi networks are multiple channels. Each channel is discrete. So you could potentially have one node sending on one channel and another node sending on another channel. And then they will not interfere. Okay? But that's not how the technology is deployed. The way it's deployed is there's only one channel in use at any given time. So, and all nodes have to use the same channel, so only one node can communicate. So it's a shared medium essentially like Ethernet, original Ethernet. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. So multiple nodes transmit, you have to do what's called a back off and have one node stop transmitting. Okay, so now with that in mind, I'm just going to give a quick overview of a protocol stack. And which is that, and we'll talk about the TCP/IP stack, then we'll use the remaining time to do a review of exam 2. Okay, so protocols, what is a protocol stack? So to understand, so this is essentially necessary material for doing remote procedure calls and so on. Okay, so essentially how communication works is if two processes in a distributed system want to communicate, we'll assume that they use what is called message communication. Okay. So message is essentially some bits that process on node A wants to send to a process on node B. Okay. Messages can be of arbitrary size. So the way it works is the process hands this message over to the operating system. It's the job of the operating system and with an address on the message saying this is where the message needs to go. This is the job of the operating system to get it to its destination. And the way it would typically do is, since messages can be of arbitrary size, it will chop this message up into smaller packets, smaller units of data, each of which is called a packet. It will stick an address or what is called a header, okay, an address and some other control information on each of these data chunks, and it will send each packet to a destination. Okay. So the message gets chopped up into smaller pieces, each piece is independently sent to the destination. At the destination, as each packet is received, you strip out the header and you take each of those pieces and you join them together, okay, to reconstruct the message that was sent. Okay? That is done by the operating system. Once the entire message has been reconstructed, you can actually hand that over to the process that is actually the recipient of this message. Okay, that is typically how network communication works. So data is chopped up into packets, packets are sent over the networks. There may be multiple nodes that are in the path from the source to the destination. Each node relays this packet to the next node until it gets to the destination. Okay. So analogy here is basically, if you think of the way traffic works, road traffic, not network traffic. So you basically have cars that go on roads and there are police that are directing cars. Your cars are analogous to packets, the roads are analogous to a network, and the police is analogous to nodes that are doing the routing, okay, which are routers. Okay. Just as you can have traffic jams on roads, you can also have traffic jams on networks. Okay. Networks can get congested. Okay. So your intermediate node, if they get too much traffic, can start throwing away your packets. Okay. If you send a packet from machine A, then there is no guarantee that the packet will actually reach its destination. Some intermediate router can just discard that packet. Okay, in that case, machine has to retransmit that message or packet until it eventually gets there. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind. And the network protocol, in this case, it's the transport protocol, it's going to actually keep track of which packets have been received, which packets have been lost, and decide which ones to resend, etc. So if you look at a typical protocol stack within the operating system, okay, it uses a layered architecture. Okay, the very first class, when we are talking about overstructured, I introduced a layered architecture. I said the only place it's used in the kernel is in the network protocol stack. Okay, so now we look at it in some more detail. Okay. So here what we have are three nodes, A, B and C. Right? B is an intermediate node, often referred to as a router or a routing node. A and C are source and destination node. They are sort of nodes on your network. Okay? So this is essentially the layering that is used by your network stack, both at the source and the destination. Okay? And at each layer you use what is called a protocol. A protocol is just a set of rules for communication. Yes, both parties have to agree on the rules of communication before communication can actually take place. Okay, so what are the rules that you have to agree to? Okay, the rules that you have to agree to are things like, if you have some header or control information, what does that look like? Okay, what are the fields of the header? What do they tell you? How should you interpret this field? So you have to agree what those are, and if you agree on them, then you are basically talking a certain protocol. It's like a language that you use for communication. Okay. Now if you take what is called a protocol stack, which is you have different layers in a network stack, each of them is responsible for a different function. Okay. At the very top you have the application. So your application, it could be a web browser, wants to talk to a web server. Okay. So at this level they may talk HTTP. Okay. That's the protocol they have agreed to use. Okay. Hypertext Transfer Protocol, that's a protocol. Okay. And then you have several layers in the protocol stack. There's something called the presentation layer, something called the session layer, transport, network, data link layer, and the physical layer. Okay. So basically each of them is responsible for a certain job. Presentation layer is responsible for deciding how to take the packet that you have received, how to take the message and present it to the application. Session layer decides session specific information. Okay, typically, we look at the most commonly used protocol stack today, which is the TCP/IP stack. These two are missing. Okay, they are not present in those stacks. You have the data link layer, the network layer, transport layer, and only the application layer. Okay, so I'm only going to talk about these three because they are the ones that are there in most common protocols. Okay, so, transport layer is responsible for end-to-end processing. Okay, so, whenever machine A wants to communicate with machine B, okay, you have to first establish a connection between machine A and machine B. This is done by the transport layer. As each packet is sent, okay, the transport layer keeps track of which packets are numbered. Okay, they are called sequence number. As each packet is sent, the transport layer has to keep track of which messages have been sent. For every message that reaches the other end, that machine is supposed to send an acknowledgement. Acknowledgement tells the sender that packet was received. So you have to keep track of which acknowledgements have been received. If an acknowledgement is not received, you have to say that maybe the packet was lost. That's why the node has not acknowledged it. You have to resend. All of this functionality is done at the transport layer. Okay? So in the TCP/IP protocol stack, okay, the T part of the TCP protocol is what runs at the transport layer. There are other transport protocols such as UDP and others, but the TCP is the most common one. Okay, that's the transport layer. The network layer is responsible for node-to-node communication. The transport layer is responsible for end-to-end, okay, between A and C. The network layer is responsible for node-to-node. So there's a network protocol that is responsible for sending the packet from here to here. The network protocol here is responsible for sending packet on the next hop and so on. Okay. So for each intermediate hop, the network layer decides which is the next machine to send it to. So what the network layer essentially does is what's called routing. Okay, it decides how to route the message from the source to the destination. Okay, so in TCP/IP, what is called the IP protocol, internet protocol, is the network layer of the TCP/IP stack. Okay, so here your TCP, UDP, here your IP. The data link layer is essentially your LAN technology. Okay, it could be Ethernet, it could be Wi-Fi, it could be 3G, whatever technology you use to get the to get the bits out on the wire or on the air is what is done at the data link layer. So that the protocol you use there is called the data link protocol. The medium you use is the physical layer, whether it's wire, fiber optics, wireless, that is basically the physical layer. Okay, so every protocol stack essentially has protocols defined at each of these layers. The most common one is TCP/IP. There are some others, but we'll not worry about them here. Okay, but now how the way packets are usually sent is application generates a message. Okay, it sends it down the protocol stack. It gives it to the OS. OSFIL, it will, each of these layers will do some processing on the packets and send it to the layer below it. So it will go all the way down to the physical layer. The physical layer will send it to the next node. It will go up the protocol stack. The network layer here will decide what's the next node to send it to. The next node here is C. So it comes back down the protocol stack. It comes to C. At C, it will then go up the protocol stack, as this arrow shows, send it to the application then. The application will get this message, they'll do some processing. If it's a HTTP request, this is a web server, the application has to generate a response to this HTTP request. The contents that were requested, those contents will become the response, which is another packet, it goes down the reverse path. Okay, and it will be the response will be received by the application. Okay, so this is essentially how protocol stacks look like. So here is an example of what I was just saying, which is the TCP/IP protocol stack. So layer 1 here, so this is basically your physical layer. Okay. Data link layer is either 802.11, which is the name for Wi-Fi, 802.3, which is the name for Ethernet or some similar technology. Okay. So that is the protocol that's used at the data link layer. Network layer is IP. Transport layer is UDP or TCP. Okay. And then the application layer, you have a whole bunch of them. Okay. FTP, SMTP, SMTP is the mail protocol, FTP file transfer protocol, HTTP web protocol, practically any of these protocols that you hear about, SNMP, they're all at the application layer. Okay. They allow you to write distributed applications. Okay. So that is essentially a very quick overview of your protocol stack. Are there any questions on this? So, a quick primer on networking. Next time we are going to talk about remote procedure calls. Next time is essentially a week from today. Tuesday there is no class because of the exam.
It's a week from today.
I'm sorry?
So, more than a week from today. Next Thursday. Right?
Oh, next Thursday, not a week from today. A week from Thursday. You're right. Okay, so let me now go back to exam review. And say a few words about the exam. So the exam is going to be on memory management. There's no other material. Only memory management is included on the test. Okay, so include this. Slides are already up on the web. If you want to go review it. So like last time, I would strongly recommend that you start from the class slides. Okay. Look at the material I covered on these PowerPoint slides that I put up. Use that as the basis for understanding what material to study for the test. Okay, I'm not going to ask you about stuff that we did not cover in class. Okay, so the lecture slides are sort of the definitive place to start. And then you look at the book and understand the material that is sort of corresponds to in the book. Okay, so memory management, so you need to understand what is virtual memory, why do we use it. There we looked at several memory allocation strategies. We started with contiguous allocation, first fit, best fit. We did paging, segmentation and page segmentation. Okay, you should know paging and segmentation by now because that's what you did in the lab. Okay, so I'm assuming that you remember what those are. Page segmentation combines the two. Okay, so it takes segmented view of the process and pages each of the segments. Okay. For each of those strategies, there could be a different types of question. Okay. One would be address translation. What is the hardware support needed to implement that strategy? Okay. We looked at page tables, we looked at segment tables, we looked at registers, we looked at error checks to figure out bounds. So all of that hardware, you need to understand which one applies to which of those strategies. Okay. So address translation, hardware support, then you need to understand which strategies suffer from what kinds of fragmentation. Okay. Essentially, contiguous allocation has both internal and external. Paging has only internal. Segmentation also has external and internal. Page segmentation has only internal. So you need to understand what kinds of fragmentations can occur, which strategies are able to grow the size of processes easily or shrink their sizes, and in which strategies is it harder. Okay, anytime you have paging or segmented paging, it's very easy. Okay, whenever your contiguous allocation is hard, because if the whole is not big enough, process grows, you are essentially out of luck. Okay? Same is true of ability to move processes. Okay? If you page it out and page it in, how does that work? Okay? Which schemes make it easy to share memory across processes? Okay? Paging, segmentation, they all make it easy. Contiguous allocation is not possible. Okay? What memory protection exists? Okay, or not exist, but is implemented to ensure that one process does not get access to some other process's memory. Okay. And what needs to happen on a context switch? Okay, so you need to save TLBs, you need to save page table entries, etc. Okay, so all of those things that we covered in class. Okay, you should be able to analyze the performance slowdown due to any of these hardware schemes. Okay, so we looked at page tables. We said you could keep the page table in a TLB, could keep it in memory. We did several exercises on the board which said what is an effective memory access, EMA. Okay, what kind of slowdown do you see because of any particular performance scheme? Okay, so you should be able to analyze that. Saying if you have a paging scheme and the page table is stored in memory, every memory access requires you to access the page table and then the memory. So a factor of two slowdown. We have a TLB, that is you can have much less of a slowdown. Okay. So that kind of analysis you should be able to do. Okay. Given a request for memory, you need to be able to figure out will contiguous allocation work, what happens, etc. Virtual to physical translations. Okay. So it's you could be given a simple page table, said this is the number of frames in memory, here is a page table. This is a virtual address translated to a physical address. Okay, so you need to extract the page number and the offset, use the page number to index into the page number, page table, get a frame number and say this is the physical address. Okay, so we did those kinds of exercises. So you need to be able to do similar, solve similar problems. Okay, as far as the paging is concerned, you need to know what a paging is. What kinds of information does a page table store? What is a translation lookaside buffer? It's a cache for the page table. How is it used? Need to understand that. What happens when there is a TLB miss? What does the operating system have to do? It has to fetch the page table entry, stick it into the TLB, all of those things. Okay. So that is basically the first four schemes that we looked at. Okay. The last one, which was the most general one, was demand paging. Okay, in demand paging, we assume that the process as a whole is not resident in memory. Only parts of a process are stored in memory. The rest is stored on swap space or on disk. Okay. So how does demand paging work? How are pages fetched in memory? Okay, the notion of a page fault. Whenever you try to access a page that is not resident in memory, the process generates a page fault. Okay, OS is now then going to go fetch that page for the process on the fly. Until then, the process is suspended. Okay, then once you get it, you will update the page table entry, the page becomes available. You restart the instruction. Okay? So all the steps that need to take place to service a page fault. Okay? So need to understand those kinds of details. Again, analyzing given, I think there's something on that. Analyzing, say, if there is a page, if page faults occur at a certain frequency, what kind of slowdowns they can see and so on. We did an exercise of that form in class. Okay, all of these exercises are there on the lecture slides. Okay, so if you don't remember, please go review them. They are all there. So you will understand what kinds of questions to expect. Okay, and then the last thing we looked at was page replacement. Okay, so this is the problem of if there is a page fault, you are bringing a page from disk to memory, how do you decide which page to evict, which page gets thrown out to make room for an incoming page? We looked at FIFO, we looked at OPT, which is also called MIN, an optimal policy, looked at LRU and its two variants, second chance and enhanced second chance. Understanding all of those, understanding their property, okay? Why is MIN a good or an optimal algorithm and yet it's infeasible to implement because it requires knowledge of the future. How does LRU approximate MIN? It uses knowledge of the past to do page replacement, and we assume that past is a good predictor of the future. So if that assumption is true, LRU approximates MIN. Okay, things like this. Okay, so, and also understanding why LRU, although it's a good algorithm, is expensive to implement. Okay, because the data structures you need to implement LRU are expensive. So you use crude approximations. Okay, we looked at two crude approximations of LRU, second chance and enhanced second chance. Okay, understanding all of that. And then global and per process allocation. In global allocation, there's one giant LRU list across all the processes. Okay, when one page comes in, page of an arbitrary process, the least recently used page of an arbitrary process gets thrown out. In per process allocation, each process has its own LRU list. So if you page in something, you only page out your own page. Okay, so not somebody else's page. Okay. Temporal locality, spatial locality, or what they are. Okay, why they benefit paging, notion of a working set. Okay, what is a working set? It's a set of pages a process is working on. Okay, how do you estimate the working set? You can use window-based algorithms to track which are the pages. Okay, things like this. Okay, the last few things we looked at is thrashing. What does thrashing mean? It's a condition where memory is overcommitted, so you are constantly paging. Okay, no useful work gets done. Why it occurs and what you can do to avoid it. Okay, again, we discussed this in class. We did several exercises for LRU and MIN and so on, where you are given a page reference string. Okay, and you are asked saying what kind of pages are present in which frames. Okay, in that context, we also looked at Bernoulli's anomaly. Okay, if you remember, Bernoulli's anomaly is a problem where you increase the number of pages given to a process and its page fault doesn't decrease, it increases, okay, which is counterintuitive. If you give more memory to a process, it should fault less. In Bernoulli's anomaly, a process actually faults more. Okay, trying to understand what it is, okay, which is, and then understanding through the exercise we did in class, okay, why it occurs. Okay, so those are things to keep in mind. File systems are not part of this. Right. So basically the whole discussion on memory management, I think it was 6 or 7 classes, is all part of the test. Okay, I have put up a sample exam on Spark with sample solutions. Okay, this time you don't have to turn it in. Last time I made you turn it in. Okay, you can study on your own. I'm not going to force you to turn in the exam. But it's already out on Spark if you want to take a look. Okay, so as I mentioned, there will not be any class on Tuesday. I will be available to answer your questions. So I would suggest that if you are going away for the break, at the very least you come back on Monday and review that material and come talk to me on Tuesday. Although by no means should you do that, you should start studying earlier. But the way things work, that's what you might end up doing. Okay, so I'm here on Tuesday. Anthony is around on Monday, right? What time is your office hours? 12 to 1. So he's there 12 to 1. I am there all afternoon. If you want to stop by, you can particularly stop by during class time if you want, and we can answer your questions. Okay? So that is it for today. Have a good break. I'll see you at the exam and then we'll resume next Thursday. Alright?